Welcome to the New Books Network.
The war in Israel-Palestine that began with the Hamas terrorist attacks of October 7th, 2023, has captured the attention of the world. It's led to the deaths of more than 33,000 persons, most of them women and children, and some of whom, unfortunately, have been humanitarian aid workers. The war has inflamed passions across the United States, especially, of course, on college campuses, but also in the halls of the State Department and other groups and institutions. The war has also brought to attention the growing tensions between Iran and its proxies, Hamas and Hezbollah, on one side, and Israel, the United States, and Saudi Arabia on the other. How can the conflict be resolved, if at all? Welcome to International Horizons, a podcast of the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies that brings scholarly and diplomatic expertise to bear on our understanding of a wide range of international issues. My name is John Torpy, and I'm director of the Ralph Bunche Institute at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Today, we discuss the situation in Israel-Palestine with Amos Goldberg of Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Professor Goldberg is the Jonah M. Machover Chair in Holocaust Studies in the Department of Jewish History and Contemporary Jewry, and until recently was the head of the Research Institute of Contemporary Jewry at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Among his books is the award-winning volume Trauma in First Person, Diary Writing During the Holocaust, published by Indiana University Press in 2017, and listed among Choice's 10 most outstanding books in the category of History, Geography, and Area Studies for 2018. He's also published a co-edited volume with Bashir Bashir called The Holocaust and the Nakba, A New Grammar of Trauma and History, published by Columbia University Press in 2018. Goldberg is among the initiators and drafters of the Jerusalem Declaration of Anti-Semitism. He's contributed dozens of articles to numerous media outlets in Hebrew, English, and German, including most recently the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, the New York Review of Books, Haaretz, and Local Call in Hebrew. He's currently a visiting scholar at the Center for the Study of the Holocaust, Genocide, and Crimes Against Humanity here at the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies, and we're very happy to have him. Thanks for being with us today, Amos Goldberg.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, and I want to talk to you about a very delicate and troubling subject, which is, of course, the situation in Israel-Palestine. You recently wrote an analysis of the slogan, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," and criticizing the way it has been used as a means of suppressing speech on the part of critics of Israeli policy toward the Palestinians. Maybe we could begin by having you explain your argument in that article.
Thank you very much, John, for having me. Yes, I will try to explain. I think, first of all, we have to take into consideration that this is a broader struggle over the meaning of anti-Semitism and how it is connected or disconnected or not connected, or in what sense it is connected or not connected to critique of Israel. This is a long debate which is taking place in all over Europe, America, Israel, and also other parts of the world. So that's the big question, and my take on it, that when I say very generally, that although there are some times that anti-Zionism or harsh critique of Israel somehow flows or spills over to that, could in a way that it could be considered anti-Semitic, whether it is from left-wing or other critique of Israelis or Israel and Zionism, on whether it is from even from a Palestinian or Arab from writings and expression. Overall speaking, I think two things have to be said here. Broadly speaking, they do not conflate. Those are two very different things: anti-Israel or anti-Israel occupation or anti-Israel policies, or even anti-Zionism as a national ideology is one thing, and it's legitimate. It has always been legitimate. It is legitimate towards other countries and also towards Israel. And there is anti-Semitism, which is a form of bigotry and racism that we have to fight. And so, generally speaking, so those are two different things that some political parties have an interest to conflate them. So this is one thing that I think should be said. Although, as I said at the beginning, sometimes they overlap, and I will try to try to draw some kind of a map where they overlap. And I think this is we can discuss it afterwards. And then a second thing that has to be always remembered before entering the slogan is that, to my opinion, and I think to many other experts and other viewers and other Jews and other I would say other parties or actors in this field, the real anti-Semitic threat comes from the right wing, from those who shout, "Jews will not replace us," from those from the AfD in Germany that all of a sudden became the best friend of Israel, but they have such strong Nazi roots and revisionist roots. So this is the big picture. Now let's go to the now within this big picture, there's an attempt to criminalize a critique of Israel and critique of Zionism as anti-Semitic. And from this kind of interpretation of the slogan, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," is should be understood within this context. Now, before we get, so I think it has become such a contentious slogan, which is chanted since the 60s all over the world, particularly in it started in English-speaking countries, but now it's all over the world, really, also in Latin America, in Europe, in Germany. This has become so. Before we go dive into the meaning of the word, even according to those who think that it means that it's the elimination of the state of Israel, because when you say "from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," you actually mean, which I think is wrong. I will explain in a second why I think it's wrong. This is a wrong interpretation. But even for those who think that it means only Palestine between the river and the sea and no Israel, then they have to explain, why do they accept the opposite view by Israel, from the river to the sea, by Israel policy to, or is actually what is actually happening in the actual reality on the ground between the river and the sea today? There is only one state controlling the whole area, and for many decades, its policy is to jeopardize any possibility, any option of a Palestinian state. That is doing "from the river to the sea, only Israel will be free." This is a legitimate political opinion, while the other is not. So this is kind of a hypocrisy, because as we know, today there is one state, Israel is controlling the whole area, the whole territory, from the river to the sea. Israel itself and its occupied territories. It has a settlement policy that to avoid any future Palestinian state. This is also was said, Bibi was outspoken about that. He said he will not allow in his whole policy is to prevent a Palestinian state. So Israel is not chanting from the river to the sea, but it actually does create political reality of from the river to the sea, there's only one state, which is, means only Israel will be free, no Palestinian state, no Palestinian rights. And what we have now for many, many years, that between the river and the sea, there are two almost equal in in terms of numbers, population, one Palestinian, one Israeli. Israeli Jews have almost, I mean, they have, enjoy full rights, while the Palestinian population have either no rights or partial rights. And we can distinguish between those in the West Bank that almost have no rights, those in Jerusalem have they are residents, they are not citizens, those inside Israel are citizens but are not full citizens in a sense that there are so many laws discriminating against them. And there are those in the diaspora and the refugee camps that were expelled or fled Palestine in 1948 or 1967 and still can't go back. And there are those in Gaza who we know what is happening to them. So various ways they don't have rights, while half of the population, the Jewish population, enjoy full rights. And this is what many call apartheid. So while this is a legitimate, is considered to be a legitimate Israeli policy, even if you disagree with that, just chanting from the river to the sea is criminalized and anti-Semitic. Now, so this is a, I mean, you see here the hypocrisy of this allegation. Now, if we dive into this, and there's a, quite a lot of quite a lot of research that has done on this specific chant, specific slogan by, for example, historian Maan Nasser from Arizona. Then it started in the 60s in the process of decolonization, and the Fatah and the PLO supported this slogan as in their vision, one democratic state for all, which was, of course, rejected by Israel. But since then, it became the chant, the major chant that Palestinians around the world and their supporters chant in the demonstration against the occupation, against apartheid, against settler colonialism, and against whatever. Now, what does it actually mean? It actually means what I said, that between the river to the sea, there are, all the Palestinians are not free. Now, how to, what is the way to freedom? Well, then you have many, many, you have many, many Palestinian views on that, as we have many views on every, in any, on any political issue in every society. So something, a two-state solution is the way to break free of this situation, and some kind of a solution to the right of return to all. And this was during the 80s and the early 90s, was supported by at least the vast majority of Palestinians in Palestine, according to polls. But since then, after Second Intifada and the massive aggressive settlement policy, this seems to be, according to many analysts, not feasible anymore, because there is no viable territory for state because of the aggressive racist, I would say, settlement against the international law, because it's an occupied territory and you are not allowed to transform population from your territory from the to the occupied territory. But Israel has done this, and according to almost all legal experts, it's against the international law. But there is no, it seems that there is no way to go to a viable Palestinian state. So there are other, so some chanted and still think of the way to free Palestine and Palestinians is to through a two-state solution. Something, this does not work, and we have to think of a confederation. Something of one state with or two communities. Something, and there are also those radicals, whether seculars, who have Algeria, for example, in mind, who want to expel all or most Jews, or even sometimes kill them. And there's the Islamic some who support the Muslim or Islamic political imagination of dhimmi, of an Islamic rule, whereas the Jews are somehow subordinated and inferior, but protected by the Islamic State. And some even think of expelling or even killing most of the Jews in order for this Waqf land, this holy land, to come back to Muslim control, Islamic control. But the chant itself doesn't say anything about it. The chant itself has become a very global chant, all Palestine, for the Palestinian cause. And we have to see it as a kind of a speech act. This is what you chant in supporting Palestine. What do you actually mean? As I said, many people have many interpretation. It's like, when we say once upon a time, we don't mean once upon a time. We just mean that now we are in a legend. We are in this genre of a legend. When you say Palestine, you chant this, and I chanted it, and many other chanted it in many demonstrations around the world, you just mean I support the freedom of the Palestinians now. But I have to end this. I mean, I'm talking too much, but I think I have to end this question and this answer by saying that after the 7th of October, a special sensitivity has arose, and because of the big trauma of Israelis and many others around the world. And some Palestinians themselves understood it and suggested changing this chant to be more clear that we are not about expelling or killing all the Jews. This is not what. And then they suggested, for example, from the river to the sea, everybody should be free, or all should be free, or all kinds of egalitarian emancipatory chants. Now, I'm not to say to tell the Palestinians what to chant. I'm just mentioning that some understood this sensitivity and suggested other. I could say that a friend of mine, a very dear friend of mine, that also chanted this in many demonstrations and has no very, I would say, very sound-minded, a Palestinian that is all her life is looking for some intellectual ways to think in an egalitarian way the solution, said, you cannot, and I take it very seriously, as you can say, you cannot demand us this. We are chanting 60 years just to change it because of some sensitivity of Westerns or Israelis or Jews. And I accept this also. So it's for the Palestinians, I think, mostly to decide how they want to chant in their demonstration. But per se,
Right.
and I'll just finish, as Rashid Khalidi said, and I think nobody thinks what solution do we actually mean in from the river to the sea. It's just a chant. We have to free, we have to, from a situation of unfree people to a free people. What is the how politically to get there? There are so many opinions. Nothing is hinted in the chant itself to a specific political solution.
Right. I mean, you've obviously laid a lot on the table, and it's hard to know really where to intervene now. But I mean, I guess, what strikes me in response to what you've said is, that in the meantime, there's, a war in Gaza, and 33 or 4, 34,000 people have died, most of them women and children. And this all started when Hamas, committed a terrorist attack that, killed more than 1,200 Israelis and resulted in the taking of many hostages. And, from a kind of outsider's perspective, I'm hardly an expert on this, it looked like a kind of provocation that, in its own way, would make it impossible for the Israelis to want to make peace with the Palestinians. So the prospects, insofar as they were, going anywhere before October 7th, the prospects of making some kind of long-term peaceful solution seem now, sort of off very much in the distance. And in the meantime, there's, a charge being leveled against the Israelis that they're committing a genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza. And, you know, I know you've written about this, and, you know, I think the question of genocide is a complicated one. The definition is tricky. The International Court of Justice has, as we know, you know, come to the conclusion that there's a plausible genocide taking place in Gaza. I wonder, you know, you've written about this, so what would you say, you know, is the answer to that question, which I think is obviously extremely sensitive.
Yeah, this is extremely sensitive. And whatever we think, whether it was a genocide or not a genocide, I think now, after 6 months, with so many investigations, including of Israeli investigations and including human rights and the special rapporteur to the occupied the Palestinian territory, Francesca Albanese, and the ICJ, and you know, you just name it, we can fairly certain that huge crimes, massive crimes, are taking place again. I mean, certainly war crimes, and I think many would agree, crimes against humanity in the occupied in Gaza. I would suggest, and it took me half a year to acknowledge it, that I think the word genocide or the term genocide is also applicable to this situation. And there is a genocide going on or unfolding, and who knows when it will stop. So if we tie it to the, again, to the previous question, so while this is going on in Gaza, I think attacking those who chant from the river to the sea as genocidal is a bit hypocritical, because, you know, look at what's happening on the ground and what you chant. And I mean, you cannot blame someone of implying some way genocidal when you are actually doing such horrible, when Israel is doesn't. Now, I will say, now I don't know how, there's so many layers of this question you ask. So first of all, yes, Israel had the right to self-defense after the 7th of October. The 7th of October was a crime. Some even, and not only Israeli, go as far as say that it was genocidal. Whether genocide was a genocidal, I'm not sure about that. I doubt it. I don't think so. But it was a very severe crime, the 7th of October. And the impact on Israel and Jewish society was shock and trauma. It was, as itself was, in itself was something unprecedented for many, many reasons. It really, till now, the kibbutzim are unpopulated, most of them. People, you know, the figures are known, 1,200 on the first day, some 850 of them killed were civilians, children, elderly. Yes, there was rape, there was rape. There were atrocities. Not all that was published is right, but basically yes. And the hostages are really an open wound. I know, like, my colleague in my department, his son is a hostage. In our neighborhood, I know people who are hostages that just a few days ago released a video clip of this. His name is Hirsch Goldberg Polin. Is released, and it's heartbreaking. And you know, I was working on my book, which some of what I say here is written there on with the, my book with the editor on 4th or 5th of October, just finishing the edit the proofs. And on the 7th of October, she was under attack. She was survived, and her daughter, but her partner is also in a hostage in Gaza. So this is an open wound and traumatic. And Israel had the right and even the obligation for self-defense. But what has been going on since then is way, 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 way more aggressive than self-defense. And it crossed the line of, I think, to my mind, certainly war crimes, certainly crimes against humanity, and to my mind, even the concept of genocide. And I will explain. Now, genocide, is a very tricky. It's a judicial concept. It comes from the international from the 1948 covenant to prevent and to punish genocide, which in December 1948 was adopted by the UN. And there it says that it's very tricky because it says like to that it is to destruct four categories of groups, racial, ethnic, religious, and national, I think, with intent. And in whole and in part, it could be in whole or in part. So, how big the part is in order for it to be considered, and to be the destructed as such. This is the as such. What does it mean as such? Not for other reasons, but for as. Now, this is very tricky, and it was political, and the whole debate about it in the UN was very political. For example, you don't have political groups because many, like the USSR, Soviet Union, opposed it because then they will might be they were afraid they would be accused of doing genocide. So it's a very tricky definition. And many scholars, historians, or political scientists did not accept this definition. Added, some spoke about ethnic cleansing in the big, like Naiman or others, that genocide, you cannot really consider the boundaries between this and other war crimes and other crimes against humanity, and it is connected to others. Some spoke about mass atrocities, 50,000 and more, that would be considered mass atrocities. Mass killing, not talk about genocide, because it is a very tricky and it's a very political definition. Nonetheless, it has power. And United States acknowledged so far eight, except for the Holocaust, eight genocides. Now, let's start with incitement to genocide. This is also part of the convention, and parties are not has to have to prevent and to punish incitement for genocide, and this is undoubtedly happens in Israel. I think there are more. There was a monitoring organization that monitored more than 500 utterances from the highest political levels to the Facebook. And to media people talking openly about destructing or completely Gaza, no innocent people in Gaza. This also said our president, Yitzhak Herzog. So there are, on this level, I think, and this is actually what the ICJ also ruled. One of the provisional measures was for Israel to do all it can to punish and stop incitement for genocide. So, and this has never been done. Just recently, a rabbi, a very influential rabbi, called for really, in the most brutal way, just kill all of them because there's no innocent, not a child, not a. And this is openly said in Israel. So, on this level, I think it is hard to say that there is not incitement. From the highest to the lowest levels, media people, as I said, influential figures in the army, in the. And that was very, very, I think, powerful step put straightforward in the ICJ by South African delegation, that the lawyers of South Africa. So on that level, I think there is, can be no dispute. There is incitement for genocide, and there is a cause for genocide, implying, explicit or implicit. Now, after the ICJ, this was reduced, but for 4 months, we heard this all over. Now, whether this is now, I think this the case for genocide in Palestine is very strong. And it is based first because of this insight and open speech. We I read some political scientists who said never before political leaders spoke so openly and expressed their desire for full destruction as in Israel. So I think it's fair to say, according to the evidence, that there was an intent. Now, Israel said, no, we didn't intend. This does not express intent. It expresses just the rage. And after the 7th of October. But when you have such atmosphere, and then you see what is happening on the ground, when actually Gaza does not exist anymore as a political, human, cultural society, it does not exist anymore. It was completely destructed physically and institutionally, while really killing by now more than 34,000 people. And probably many more under the rubbles. And we will, in its ongoing thing, we don't know how many will plagues and famine will be killed by the end of this war. And now they are entering Rafah. So when you compare what they said at the beginning and the end and what has happened, and after all those investigations that say that actually within this very broad hiding behind collateral damage, they were willing to kill hundreds of people and destroy neighborhoods for just one Hamas officer, then you say this is actually a genocidal logic that you can kill everyone in order to get rid of Hamas. And this is what we see. And as we know, in the cases of, for example, of Srebrenica, where the International Criminal Court for Yugoslavia, twice decided that Srebrenica was a genocide, only, quote unquote, 8,000 people, men over the age of 16, were killed, while the other were expelled. So you see here a combination of killing and expulsion, which takes also place in Gaza, that can create a genocide. The same is about the Rohingya in Myanmar, where America acknowledged it as and there also you have as a genocide just in March 9, 2022. And then you also have the combination of destruction, expulsion, and killing, just as in Gaza. And this could be considered a genocide because looking at it, you see this extreme killing, the extreme amount of destruction, and the including of all cultural, university, hospitals, everything. This is the logic of a genocide. And Israel never said that the population is going to return to their homes. So, if this is not a genocide, what is a genocide? So it's not a genocide in the sense of the Holocaust, that every Jew, and I think this is the big mistake, that we imagine a genocide only according to what the Holocaust was, that every Jew was looked after in order to be killed and exterminated systematically. This is one kind of a genocide. Maybe the Armenian genocide is similar to that. Maybe the Rwandan genocide is more close to that, is closer to that. But there are other forms of genocide, which I just mentioned, like Srebrenica or Rohingya, where the extermination takes a different shape and a different form, and not only a total annihilation of all the population. And I think the Gaza seems more like this kind of genocide. And as I say, just using the human rights discourse of we actually expelled all the Palestinians or most of the Palestinians in order to avoid more civilian casualties is not an excuse. As Francesca Albanese rightly, I think, mentioned in her report, the Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur, the UN rapporteur for human rights conditions in the occupied Palestinian territories, she said, this is using the human rights rhetoric to camouflage the actually ethnic cleansing, which is part of the big picture of a plausible genocide act.
Right. Right. I want to intervene. I mean, this is an important discussion, obviously, and a very difficult one of definition and intention and all these kinds of issues and how it compares to other cases of genocide. And, you know, so you mentioned the Holocaust, that this may be a genocide, but not, you know, one like the Holocaust. But this gets at, you know, the issues, I think, that underlie the whole conflict, and that is, you know, the sort of idea of Israel as this safe haven from, you know, f the to avoid future kinds of Holocausts. And but you've written an article that, you know, was very interesting to me, that is based on an article, I guess, that Charles Mayer wrote in the American Historical Review about kind of the historical memories that we live with, or the narratives of 20th century history that we kind of, that are the main ones that we are using these days. And that is this sort of notion of settler colonialism on the one hand, and of Holocaust memory on the other. And it strikes me as though this, you know, in Israel, these two ideas clash head on. Right, the memory of the Holocaust as, you know, the worst, obviously the worst thing that ever happened to the Jewish people, in a story that involves a lot of bad things, and, you know, at the same time there's this issue of, you know, the displacement and dispossession of the Palestinian population. And I guess the question basically is, you know, are these two narratives kind of, you know, can they be resolved? Because that, it seems to me, is the, you know, underlying problem that we're facing in Israel-Palestine. So how are those two narratives going to be reconciled with each other? I mean, it's sort of the same question as how is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict going to be resolved? But since you've written a lot about this, I thought I'd ask it to you in that way.
In a way, first of all, I'm very pessimistic. I don't think it could be resolved. I don't see any ray of hope right now. But the books and the articles that we either co-edited or co-written, I co with Bashir Bashir, actually deal with that. How do we put the two memories together in order to create some kind of a future? The memory of the Holocaust is the foundational, if I will use Alon Confino term, foundational past of Israel, and the Nakba, which is the foundational past of the Palestinians. How do we put them together? While each of them is not only a local, is anchored within a much bigger historical narrative. And as you said, I think Charles Meyer wrote it already. I think it was 2000, or and many other followed suit also in Germany. And I think it makes sense to say that, you know, it's very general, but still that two major historical narratives explain to us modernity. One focuses on the Holocaust, and one focuses on the anti and colonial, anti or post-colonial. Anti or post-colonial narrative. Each one focuses on other atrocities and other victim groups, and there are also very many connections between them. But they collide. They don't live well with one another, and you can see you but the place, and for example, in South Africa, they also had some kind of a fight. They had a I have a very I think very interesting. A student wrote a book recently. She did a call on her, turned her PhD into a book. Her name is Dr. Roni Mikel Arieli. Showed that this also played out in South Africa, for example. So, the ANC and the anti-apartheid movement, of course, anchored the rights in the anti-colonial struggle, while the regime was willing to acknowledge the Holocaust, but to disconnect it from issues of racism, just about anti-Semitism. So they somehow, in this way, could have more the Jewish community on their somehow on their side. And as we know, the Jews in South Africa were also very much involved in the anti-apartheid movement. But this was played out in South Africa. But the place where they really clash head on and very violently is in Palestine, Israel, because as I said, the Holocaust story is a foundational story for Israel. The foundation. Now, what is the historical connect? What are the historical connections? That's another issue. But in our minds, as Israelis, Holocaust is foundational. And for the Palestinians, since some started talking about the Zionists in this context of imperialism and colonialism, the afterwards settler colonialism, since the beginning of the 20th century, even before, and certainly after 1917, the Balfour Declaration, that is part of an imperial oppression of the local indigenous people. So these two narratives really clash on Israel-Palestine. And we can see it really. I wrote recently a piece, a chapter in my book that tries to follow this trajectory of these clashes. Now, I think both narratives have merit, and both narrative has a lot have a lot of justice in it. I mean, the Holocaust actually was the end of an era of Jews in Europe. Very, no, not in, and actually the modern anti-Semitism since the end of the 19th century proved to Jews, and Jews acknowledged that within the new formation, political formation of Europe, European political formation of nation states in East and West Europe, they have no future. And that ended up in the Holocaust. And after the Holocaust, there was an urgent need to create a polity, a Jewish a polity for the Jews. And this was done in Israel and in Palestine of that time. Now, as I said, Zionism started before the Holocaust, and I said it was to a large extent an outcome of modern anti-Semitism. Herzl was undoubtedly influenced by what urged him to create the Zionist movement was anti-Semitism, was the Dreyfus Affair and anti-Semitism in France, but not only in France, and the masses who supported Zionism in East Europe supported them, supporting it because of anti-Semitism, though we have to acknowledge that most Jews in East Europe or most Jews in the world did not support Zionism until the Holocaust. It was a minority among in the Jewish political sphere. But and Palestine became also a haven for many of the Holocaust survivors who rehabilitate themselves, created new lives, and came to Palestine. Some came because that was the only option that they could find. They wanted to leave Europe after the Holocaust. Some did not want to come to Palestine and went to other destinations, to America, to Canada, to Latin America or to wherever they could, but not to Palestine. But many did come to Palestine and did want to create, as I said, a Jewish polity as an answer, as a response to the Holocaust. On the other hand, this land was not empty. And there was already a political community there, which became a national, a nation, a people was there, the Palestinians. And for the Palestinians, and viewing those Zionists who came under the auspice of the great powers, particularly Great Britain of that time, since the beginning of the 20th century, trying not to integrate into the existing social and political structure, but to create their own political structure on the ruins of the existing political structure, which was Palestinian. This is settler colonialism. And this is what actually happened. And in 1948, in the war, an ethnic cleansing took place. And all, I mean, you know, there are volumes of what really happened there. But to my opinion, it was an ethnic cleansing, which is typical to settler colonial violence. And since then, there's an ongoing Nakba by the of the Palestinians, and in order to explain, and I think it has a lot of merit, it is the Nakba, which is ongoing because, as we said at the beginning, the Palestinians don't have their own the rights, not political, not individual for full rights. So it's an ongoing Nakba of occupation, of human rights violation, of violence, and now in Gaza, or perhaps a genocide. I believe it is, but at least it's a plausibly genocide as the ICJ. And this is anchored and understood within, I think rightly so, within the big picture of the settler colonialism. So as I said, both narratives, in as they clash, they have merit, they are truthful. And we have to find a way to combine them in a way that will be historical truth and open the new to new horizons of political agenda. And we believe that, yeah.
I'm afraid we're going to have to wind it up there. I mean, I know you're a pessimist. I'm pretty pessimistic these days myself, but those last words were, at least in a certain sense, optimistic. At least they kind of lay out a roadmap for where this might go.
So,
I mean, I'm not holding my breath that it's going to happen anytime soon, but that somehow some kind of recognition and reconciliation of these two historical narratives is what has to take place.
yeah, can I just say that the last word is like what Bashir and I call, and I think Bashir mostly developed it, egalitarian binationalism. That we have to, that both narratives are valid, and all, like, we have to voice. We have the all have the right to voice their narrative, and both are right, and we have to combine them. And all have, and both people have a complete equal rights, political, individual, and civil rights. This is egalitarian binationalism. It could be cashed out in various political structures: one state, two state, confederation, whatever. But the idea is egalitarian binationalism, acknowledging those two entities, but in a completely egalitarian way to solve the problem. But this is almost science fiction today.
Yes, I'm afraid it probably is, certainly for the foreseeable future. All right, I gotta wrap things up. As I say, I want to thank Amos Goldberg for sharing his insights about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the history behind it. I want to thank Osvaldo Mena Aguilar for his technical assistance and to acknowledge Duncan McKay for sharing his song International Horizons as the theme music for the show. This is John Torpy saying thanks for joining us, and we look forward to having you with us for the next episode of International Horizons.